Through the mists of the unknown, certain people have delved deep to find answers. UFOs and unexplained phenomenon, magic and mysteries, myths and monsters. We examine these mysteries to determine, are they real or part of our fanciful imagination? Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is out there. And those of us who delve deep include Mr. Mark Finn.
I want to believe that The X-Files is a good show.
Mr. Mickey Finn.
Stalking in the night.
Mr. Aaron DiOrive.
I don't like the mythology episodes.
And I'm your host, Leonard Nimoy. No, I am not.
Wow.
I am not. I am Joseph Fotinos. And this is In Search Of. No, it is not. It is the Gentlemen Nerds. And in this episode, we are examining the mysterious, the unknown, focusing on a little show that you may have heard of called The X-Files, recently returned to television.
The Gentlemen Nerds is brought to you by and... Wait, I can't say that? That's been redacted? Well, can I say it's been... No? Okay, it's brought to you by people. It's not brought to you by people. All right then, let's go to the velvety sounds of the Lobot Lounge.
We've already sort of put some stuff out there in our intro. We found out that some of us aren't necessarily big fans of The X-Files. Some of us don't like certain episodes. Some of us feel strongly about one thing or the other. I think The X-Files, in its purest form, is incredibly entertaining. However, you really got to be invested in it. Now, Mark Finn, yes. You did mention that you weren't necessarily a fan of this show. I'd like to start with you, sir.
Well, okay. I was planning on taking the hot seat anyways. And so I'm going to say this, you know, without acrimony, you know, whatsoever, because I have watched seasons of The X-Files. I had a girlfriend who was into The X-Files during its heyday. So, like the Jules Whitfield's transitive property of vegetarianism, you know, my girlfriend's a vegetarian, which pretty much makes me a vegetarian.
That's right.
I had to watch The X-Files. And so this was my this show was not bad. It made me a fan of both David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, you know, no doubt. They were great on the show.
And Mitch Pileggi.
And Mitch Pileggi, yeah. And I liked their chemistry. They were great. Not an issue. What I took offense to was early on in the show, Chris Carter made the very bold statement that Mulder and Scully were not going to get together romantically. And they made that a very prescient point. Like that was, you know, get out of your heads because it's not going to happen. And I think most fans accepted it, although there were some fans who were like, oh, yeah, just wait. But what they replaced that sort of trope with was this notion of a mystery surrounding Mulder's sister.
Right, the mystery. His sister was abducted, if I recall.
Yes, she was abducted, yes. and that's what fed into him becoming, you know, involved with the X-File cases. So like in terms of that, that's really good. Except that the mythology, the working theory, kept changing every time they did a Fox's sister episode. They would say it was aliens, and then they go, no, it wasn't aliens. It was those rascally kids and old man Miller over at the haunted amusement park. And then they would go, oh no, it's a conspiracy. Oh, it's not a conspiracy. It's actually aliens. And I really quickly figured out, to my chagrin, that was just them moving the goalposts every time.
Yeah.
You know, because this was back when they weren't writing to a finite ending. And the idea was that the show was theoretically supposed to go on and on and on. And so I did the math in my head and went, oh, they're never going to do this. It's just going to be more episodes where – the underpinnings change.
Did you get far enough to find out what actually happened to his sister?
I quit watching it after season 7, which was the Darren McGavin season, where it was Monster of the Week. Yeah. I did,
and I was going to say, Mark, you what you described about them moving the goalpost, that sure sounds a lot like Lost, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I felt like Lost at least knew that they were going to have to wrap it up. I never got that impression with the X-Files.
Well, the problem with Lost knowing that they were going to have to wrap it up was that they seemed to just keep procrastinating and never actually addressing it anyways.
Well,
so.
Sure.
Well, also, by the way, they did exactly what Mark just said that he didn't like that they did about X-Files. In Lost, early on, and I don't remember who it was or who said it, but early on, someone said, "Oh no, they're not all dead and in limbo."
Yes,
and everyone went, "It can't be that." Yeah. And then, gee, guess what? They're all dead and in limbo.
Right, right. Somebody figured it out, and they
exactly. And so they said, "Shit, what are we going to do?" They figured it out like 5 episodes in. Yeah. What are we going to do? We've got years to go. Yeah. So,
that was actually something that shows like the X-Files was actually the training ground, which by the time people got to Lost, we'd seen all this stuff already. So, but that's
okay. You want to know what actually happened to Mulder's sister?
Sure. Spoilers. Here there be spoilers. Go ahead.
Give me a second. I'm almost finished.
Okay.
I do want to know, but I'll tell you this. All that said, there were some episodes that I really enjoyed. They tended to be the one-off episodes, that basically existed kind of as a single unit. The cockroach episode.
Fluke Man.
The Fluke Man episode.
In fact, you know what? This leads beautifully. I have a list that I have compiled.
Okay.
What are considered some of the top X-Files episodes, and I want to read that really quick because it probably covers a lot of what you guys are talking about.
Not in order, I assume.
Not in order. Not in no particular order. The episodes that seem to be talked about a lot the most on fan sites and such are The Host, that's the Fluke Man, X-Cops, an episode called Dreamland, one called Dwayne Barry, then there's The Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man, which actually is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. It's where he wants to be a science fiction writer, and he keeps sending the stories off. It's so well done. Pusher. Another one is called Ice. That's the one where But that's why it's good, because they pick up a great source.
Yes.
There's Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which universally is everyone talks about that one being one of their favorites. Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
Uh-huh.
I love that one. Oh, my God. Alex Trebek? Anyway. Anasazi, I think that's one of the mythology ones, where they go looking at all the symbols that the Native Americans had.
I didn't like that one.
The Postmodern Prometheus,
which
is about Mutato, if you remember Mutato, the guy with two faces. Mm-hmm. Tombs, one of my favorites, about the guy that has to eat people's livers and can crawl through.
Oh, yeah.
Bad Blood.
That was the incest episode, right?
No, that's Home.
Oh, okay. That's Home, yes. That's
Home is probably the most... without a doubt, it is the most disturbing X-Files episode
I have ever
seen. Yeah. They refused... They didn't re-air it because it was so disturbing.
Yeah.
And then finally, Darkness Falls. Again, in no particular order. Yeah. If listeners want to go and check out those particular episodes, those seem to come up again and again and again on various sites.
I'm going
to
add the two Darren McGavin episodes from season 6.
Without a doubt, yes.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Darren McGavin, Chris Carter has gone on record as saying that his inspiration for The X-Files, Chris Carter, creator of The X-Files, was a little show from the 1970s called Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Oh, gosh, how could it not?
Starred Darren McGavin as Carl Kolchak, a reporter in Chicago in the TV series. Originally, the show focused on Carl Kolchak. It was a made-for-TV movie, and Jeff Rice wrote the screenplay.
With Matheson.
With Matheson, yes, right, with Matheson.
Nice.
And he was a reporter in Las Vegas, who in the standalone made-for-TV movie was investigating what appeared to be murders committed by an honest-to-God vampire.
Right.
So we were asked to take the position of Kolchak in the fact that he said, what does this guy think, he's a vampire? Is he killing to be a vampire? No. In the end, we find out It's an honest-to-God vampire right. named Janos Skorzeny. Right. And Janos has been doing this for many, many years, and he comes across this fairly frumpy, alcoholic reporter.
Sarcastic reporter.
Who has to face this thing. And let's face it, the original Night Stalker, the TV movie, was outstanding, and it terrified no bones about it. It terrified me as a child.
It was great.
Because of Skorzeny. He was rat-faced, black eyes, yellow wrinkled skin. Didn't speak a word in this TV movie. He hissed. He made guttural sounds. He was a creature. Yet he did speak because people talked about having interaction with him. The brilliance of that was that we took the position of Kolchak watching this from that point of view.
Yeah.
So everything we saw of Skorzeny was kind of through Kolchak's eyes, or the little bits we saw of him.
Right.
It's made him terrified.
It's him, and it was always Kolchak trying to explain
that's right.
away what this that's could right. possibly be.
And his editor thinks he's nuts.
Right.
Yeah. Vincenzo thinks he's nuts. So a big hit for ABC. So they followed
Huge.
It up with a.
It actually blew away any other television movie ever done.
It was brilliant.
54% of America was judged to have watched it due to the ratings.
Wow.
Holy shit.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
And by the way, that Kolchak the Night Stalker was my introduction to that kind of a show with that premise of there's things out there, mm-hmm. someone's investigating, whether they're real or not.
I'm not sure there was another show before that.
Well, I mean, I include some of the Twilight Zone and Outer Limits kind of thing, but those were not my, I mean, they existed before, but they were not my introduction. Like Joseph, I first started watching the Kolchak movie. I remember seeing it when I was a kid, and then I started watching the episodes. And same thing, they, you know, I look at them now and they're well done, but they terrified me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
They scared the shit out of me.
Well, the follow up to the Night Stalker was the Night Strangler, which was a second TV movie with Richard Anderson, yes, Oscar Goldman himself, as an alchemist living in Seattle. And this alchemist in Seattle was murdering women to take the spinal fluid from the back of their brains and using it to create an elixir that would extend his life. He was an alchemist, and he lived.
I do not remember that.
It was the second feature that
Holy
they did.
Shit.
Yep.
Yes, the Night Strangler.
You can actually get it as a double DVD set.
Yes, I'll lend it to you. I have it.
Thank you.
And then of course the TV show, which. Really great episodes, but eventually bogged down by the fact that it became Monster of the Week.
Yeah. I mean, by the time they're with that weird dinosaur alligator guy that's running around that lab,
the final episode.
Thank God, because that really was the nail in the coffin.
And they're on Netflix now, by the way. Netflix.
Yes,
but as of this recording, they are free on Netflix.
Yes, no, absolutely. That my wife and I sat and we watched all of them. Mm-hmm. I was like, "Do you remember the show?" And I saw a couple of them. I went, "Oh, honey, you're in for a treat."
Yeah.
So we sat and watched the whole.
So truly, the appeal of that show, the TV movies, the series, really for me and for most people was McGavin.
Yes. Oh yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah.
He held. He was the glue that held that together. Him and Vincenzo, that relationship, even going to see Gordy the Ghoul from time to time in the morgue and having those interactions with him and that sort of thing. Chris Carter loved that show and obviously tried to sort of emulate that with the X-Files. He even hinted at one point that he was going to get Darren McGavin to reprise his role as Carl Kolchak and meet Mulder in a bar somewhere. You know, and be grizzled and old and you know, that sort of thing. Obviously, McGavin did show up.
As Arthur Dale.
As a thinly disguised Carl Kolchak.
He was the original guy working on the X-Files.
Yep.
As soon as the door opened and I saw it was Darren McGavin, I let out a squeal that my girlfriend did not understand. I was like, you've got to be kidding me!
That's awesome. Now, that's the one, that's the episode where the hurricane is hitting,
no,
right?
No, that's the second one.
That's the second one.
The first one is where Mulder goes, it takes place in 1990, where the guy who dies says the name Mulder, and he's actually referring to Mulder's father, and this is before Mulder had heard of the X-Files.
Right.
And cool. it's mostly an episode of flashbacks.
It was those two episodes with McGavin, though, that actually, because I was ready to tell my girlfriend, you know what, I love you, but I can't do this. And then they dropped that, and I'm like, well, I'm all right, you had me. You had me at McGavin.
I think season 7's where they started doing the let's see how gross we can get.
Yeah. Yeah.
season.
And similarly, Mark Finn, I had a girlfriend who was a big Whovian, and therefore I was also a Whovian.
Yeah, buddy. Oh, yeah. The same girlfriend was also a Whovian. So, yeah. Once again, we're parallel Earths.
Yes. I grew up, I watched a little bit of Doctor Who, like the Tom Baker Doctor Who, then I sort of dropped off on it. It was cute, whatever. I liked it. Then I got into Sylvester McCoy because of my girlfriend. That was it.
Sadly, my aborted attempt at becoming a Whovian was in the early to mid 80s. It had started showing on some local channel in Austin. I just moved up to Austin to come to college. And a friend of mine said, oh, you got to watch this show. It's called Doctor Who. You're really going to love it. Okay, great. So we sat down. We had our pizza. We had our soda. We're ready to go. And it was a black and white episode with bee people.
And, oh, fun.
And my friend turned to me and he goes, No, it's really good. Trust me. Let's not watch this episode. I'm like, no, I'm going to watch this.
Well, it's like BBC America keeps trying to hook people by showing repeats of the two worst modern Who. It's like, what?
Yeah. No, that's not going to do it. So yeah. I will tell you this. I have not. Now my wife is an X-Files fan, huge X-Files fan. We are a house divided at the moment. But I have told her that since this appears to be a limited run, it's
six episodes.
Yeah. So
it's a miniseries.
My hope is that this will have an ending scripted into it, and it will be a complete 6-part story. We have not watched the shows yet. We're going to watch them together.
The first two are linked.
That bodes well. You know,
the third episode is going to be a comedy episode. So we don't know if that one's linked, but it probably is. I suspect that there's a linkage between all six.
Well,
and by the way, we liked the second episode much more than the first episode.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see how the other ones play out.
The effects are much better, too.
Oh, sure.
I mean, they are not skimping at all. They are impressive.
I like the idea of having that outsider trying to prove something. It's always been an appealing point of view. And I think the X-Files succeeded in the beginning, in its initial run, because we were Mulder and Scully. We were Mulder either going for, I believe it, you got to believe me, I got to prove it, or Scully the skeptic going, it could be this or it could be that. I also really enjoyed how Mulder was flawed. Because he was. He was definitely a flawed human being. He was addicted to porn. Yeah. He was one of these guys that just, he had all these faults to him. And he again reminded me of Carl Kolchak, who was this very flawed individual.
I do like the fact that David Duchovny has managed to make a career out of playing somebody who's addicted to porn.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
I'll never forget one of the scenes in one of these later episodes. I think it's actually an episode where they were also drinking Scheinerbach in a bar. You know, in Austin in the mid 90s, that was a shout out of epic proportions. But Scully calls him and she can hear noises over the phone. She goes, Mulder, what are you watching? He goes, I'm watching World's Deadliest Bee Sting Attacks. And she goes, oh, God. I don't even want to know, because what you're hearing is, and so, you know, they finish the conversation, and as they're wrapping the conversation up, they do this slow circular pan, and sure enough, that's exactly what Mulder is watching. But I like the fact, you know, he pauses, you know, he does that David Duchovny thing where he, you know, just pauses, you know, just enough that you think, you know, he's thinking up something. And so it was a good gag. I thought, you know, you can really only use that one time, but that was a pretty well-written thing. So
his Fox Mulder is such a dry delivery that after a while you're like, can he act? And then they do something with a comedy thing and he's got excellent comedy timing and you're like, oh yeah, he can act. That's a deliberate choice.
I got to tell you, probably the one thing that kept me from really enjoying the series was the fact that they never decided until later, right, Mickey? Until later about the mythology. This is how I've always explained it. If you want to do a story where JFK is assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, by himself, and that's your premise, then I'm okay with that. Now tell me a good story. If you want to tell me that JFK was assassinated by a massive conspiracy and Oswald was the patsy and it was there were three viable candidates and we're going to – at the end of it, we're going to tell you who we think actually did it. But
Elvis.
we're gonna let you figure all that out in the meantime. I'll say, okay, I'm in. Tell me your story. But when you every week go, Oswald, a group, Oswald, the Cubans, Oswald, CIA,
right.
When I go, I can't – I can't be your boyfriend. You know what I mean? I just can't do that.
And then – but and so then to make it worse, because I was never a fan of mythology, although I'm intrigued by the whole UFO phenomenon and all that kind of thing. But anyway – so now, spoiler alert, it seems that they're going with it's not aliens. It's a human Illuminati star chamber using alien technology
to control the populace.
Okay. And I mean, I just talk of all the choices they could have made that would have made me like the mythology less.
Right.
That's the one.
Right.
That's the one.
Well, if Mulder Sisters gets brought up again, well,
By the way,
Mickey, what did happen to Mulder Sisters?
She was killed.
By who?
By just a normal person.
Oh, okay.
He
so
misremembered
the
abduction as you know, psychological trauma, basically.
Okay.
She was abducted by somebody
right
through her
Mark
window
said.
And killed.
We're going right back to what Mark said. It's the Cubans. It's Oswald.
It was a random killing.
But you're right. You know, but that's annoying. That is annoying.
Yeah,
I mean, if you make the mystery interesting enough, even if some people guess it, that's okay.
Well,
that's
also,
okay.
The whole thing about the sister being a random killing would have been okay had they not pre-established that there was some sort of weird mystery from both Mulder's father and the alien, the unkillable, you know, man in black type character that was going around killing people with spikes through their neck, you know, was involved with the sister missing. And then suddenly we're just tossing all that out.
So why did the island move again?
I don't know, but leading up
third
to
base.
The island moving, that was the best sequence in the entire show.
Yes, but it always frustrated me that apparently the solution to everything on Lost was putting this giant stone dildo in a hole.
Yes.
Stick it in there and we'll be good.
Yep. Yeah.
Can you do that? Great, we're done.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny that we mentioned Monster of the Week on Kolchak. And that was definitely kind of a thing. But it's funny that my favorite X-Files episodes were – you know, kind of I guess at the time it was a respite from how many times do you have to see something in the woods and explain it away, Dana Scully?
Right.
How many times, Fox,
you're
going to
love this,
gonna,
Mark.
Yeah?
You're going to love this. Scully sees something in the second episode.
Oh, shut up. Shut up.
I had to pause the show and go, what?
Well, there was a reversal that happened. I don't remember if it was season 7 or 8 where Scully, you know, with a new heart goes, how can we say that there's, you know, not proof? And Fox goes, I think it's all just a big misunderstanding. I had some personal problems. And again, if we'd have gotten that season 3 and running forward, it would have been awesome. I honestly think that you have to lay the blame at the structure of television at this time, you know, because, you know, it occurred to me just when you said 6 episodes for this new miniseries, my first thought was, oh, well, shoot, that's just one less than True Detective, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you could have done, you know, and can you imagine an X-Files episode or an X-Files storyline of the intensity of True Detective? You know,
that'd be great.
They tried to do the movie. Did you see the movie?
The movie was ass.
Movies. I saw the first one.
I haven't seen the second one. And I even tried to find the second one when we decided a couple days ago we were doing X-Files. I tried to find it on both Amazon and Netflix. It does not exist. It's been redacted.
So I saw the first one. We saw the first one in the theater. We were, okay, let's check it out.
Yeah, we did too.
I never saw the second one. I remember there were bees in the first one.
There were.
Delivering some
and Dallas.
Yes. X-Files, I think, is worthy to be, I think, talked about here in the Gentleman Nerds Lobot Lounge simply because it has become part of our ingrained culture. We recognize the idea behind the X-Files. We can say, you know, we can reference it in popular culture. It's become part of our cultural zeitgeist. I think we can all say the X-Files, the truth is out there, aliens, Mulder, Scully, Smoking Man, that whole thing has sort of become, you know, part of the idiom of what we're talking about.
Oh, definitely.
So It deserves a place in the pantheon of sci-fi television. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It stumbled quite a bit, but the standalone episodes, I think there was one that I remember, a standalone episode that, and I don't remember the name of it. Maybe somebody here does.
Okay.
Where it was told from the point of view, not of Mulder and Scully, but of somebody else who witnessed this, and Mulder and Scully arrived a la Men in Black.
That's the Jose comes from outer space.
That was it. Because he described Dana Scully as, you know, something's not right with her. Her hair is red. It's too red. It's too red.
Yeah.
Something's wrong, you know. Yeah. And we know them as Mulder and Scully, but from the point of view from this poor guy, he's thinking, oh my gosh, these, you know, the conspiracy's closing in on me, the government's coming in, these guys are, they're with the NIBs. It was brilliantly done because it was all told from a different point of view, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, and by the way, to take a show that did have, I think, in mind what was going on, what the big mystery was, Fringe, which I am a big fan of. But Fringe took that same idea that Kolchak did, that X-Files did, but they sat down at some point and said, okay, here is what's going on. This is what is going on. Right. And they worked it out. Yeah. And it was satisfying. It was a great, bizarre, wonderful thing. I never would have guessed. The final season really lost me, though. I enjoyed the final season.
We never actually watched the last six episodes after it went on hiatus, so.
Really?
Right. Did it wrap up properly?
I'd go back and watch it. I mean, it's just, to me, the whole, the men from the alternate dimension, from the future, I mean, it's just, I wish that the X-Files had done something like that. This is the answer. Regardless of what it is, it's aliens, it's not aliens, it's Atlanteans, it's whatever it is. This is the answer. And then, you know, our heroes would have discovered that, and it would have wrapped up nicely.
Fringe was a brilliant show, and I really enjoyed it for the character interaction more than anything else. I think it's this ensemble of misfits kind of put together. We do have a central character that we sort of identify with because she's normal, but then we have all these different characters and different, you know, levels of there's the con artist and his crazy, insane Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein type dad, and then Astrid or Avrid, he never said her name right.
Yeah.
I mean, and there was a cow always there. There was a brilliance about that show that flowed really well, so that when they elevated these characters and they had personal interaction and they connected, you cheered. You really wanted them to work it out.
Yeah.
And then it's a mirror dimension. Oh my gosh, what is going on? I mean, yeah, it was a really well done show.
And you know who the showrunners were?
For Fringe? I do not.
They were the guys behind the original J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie.
Oh, of course.
As previously discussed, Abrams gets credit for a lot of stuff that's not actually him doing it.
I'm actually surprised. I really thought I'd get more resistance from my my problems, but it sounds like I'm not alone.
No,
my concerns.
It's just you're further on the extreme side. X-Files had a lot of problems. There's a lot of good stuff in there. Like, I hadn't seen the second Darren McGavin episode, Bad Water, but in Spanish, Aquamal or something.
Yeah.
About a sea monster in Florida during a hurricane. I'd never actually seen that one. I went back and watched it. And I'm like, this is a fantastic episode. But meanwhile, you know, that same season has some truly horrifically bad episodes.
Well, you know, the thing is there are a lot of fans and they love that show unconditionally. And so it's not, you know, I very rarely will poo-poo another man's, you know, treasure these days. It's very, you know, because I fully accept that what I look for in a show isn't always what other people look for in a show.
Right.
And we have different things. So I definitely think as a concept, X-Files is great. I think it works more often than not. And the fact that, you know, we can think back on those episodes, again, they tended to be the ones not mired in the mythology. And you know, I could point to those and go, that's good TV. That's good. You know, I didn't see it coming. I didn't know it was going to happen or wow, what a clever way to do it, you know? The cockroach episode, of course, is just a great one, you know,
which was written by the same guy who did Jose Chen's From Outer Space.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I wonder, Clive
Bruckman's Final Repose.
I'm going to look that up now because I bet they are. There's also this.
Oh, they are. It's the same. And he's the brother of one of the producers, I believe.
Wow. Okay. Because the other one that I love is the one where they have to write the report about their I suddenly lost my train of thought. Vampires. They think they're going into a community of vampires.
Yes, that was so good.
And Scully's story is so different. You know, when they're talking about the sheriff, when Mulder's talking about him, he's all buck tooth. Yeah, ma'am. It's like, and when Scully's like, he was not buck tooth. He was Scully. And it's just, it's brilliant. But it's that concept of we're seeing two stories mm-hmm. told from two totally different points of view, and the stories change and the characters change, and it's amusing and it's fun TV
as a comedy as opposed to Akira Kurosawa.
Right.
You only need the two points, which was great. But yes, that was a great episode as well.
And in addition to Mulder and Scully, of course, we had very memorable characters like the Lone Gunman. Those three guys, and they had their own spin-off show for a while.
Which I loved.
I never saw it.
It was great.
The Lone Gunman. Yes, that's right. And that's a brilliant concept of having these and very unique characters. And that's the other thing I really enjoyed about the Lone Gunman was what there were three very unique, different personalities that were thrown together. Dean Hadlin came to the Big Stinkin' International Improv and Sketch Comedy Festival, shout out, back in the day that we threw here in Austin, and was a delightful improv comedian, actor. And we had a good time with him just hanging out and talking about X-Files and Lone Gunman and things like that. I liked that concept of the show. I liked those guys together. Also, we mentioned Mitch Pileggi. Horace Pinker himself from Shocker.
Yes.
And the character's name again, not a mythology guy, but the character's name in X-Files that he played was the Mulder's boss, right?
Yes. Whose name I've temporarily forgotten because you forgot it.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, that's
hold
fair.
On. That's
Skinner.
Skinner.
Skinner. Deputy Skinner.
Yeah, Skinner, which sounds like another horror character that he was.
Yeah, it does.
Shocker or Skinner.
The Smoking Man.
Smoking Man was another recurring character that would show up.
Who was it?
I remember an acting coach,
by the way. He runs a drama school.
That's funny. Oh,
they had
gosh.
To make him very special cigarettes because he smoked all the time on set, so they had to make him very herbal, non-threatening cigarettes for the character to constantly smoke. I thought he died in the movie. I'm dimly remembering. Spoiler alert.
He's back in the miniseries. The implication, I think, was that he died.
Right.
But when you see him in the new episode, they've done something to him.
Okay,
so,
well, that makes sense. And I apologize for not being prepared as you gentlemen are, since I did not watch the episodes, the new ones. But I just going in on the knowledge that I have of it previously, which I did watch episodes and I did enjoy them when I did see them, but I didn't just get bogged into it. Like you, Mr. Mark Finn, I felt it was too much of a commitment.
Well, it's no Babylon 5.
You know what? We're going to have to do an episode on Babylon 5 because I actually very much enjoy that show and have I just saw the first Babylon 5, I didn't see it when it was the spin-off and the Rangers and all that other kind of stuff.
There's some good characters, but the TNT messed them up.
What I like best about Babylon 5 was that they said it was going to be 5 seasons long and then they stuck to it. That was one of the first times when I was like, cool, you can write to an ending, you know? I don't know where I got that into my head. I think actually around the time that all this was sort of playing around was when the Jump the Shark website, that terminology began floating around as people online were discussing TV tropes. And it occurred to me that there was a period in time for all of these shows, no matter what they were, okay? I mean, whether we're talking Happy Days, which is, of course, where the Jump the Shark comes from.
Right.
Or even, Wonder Woman, I mean, there's a period where clearly we're out of ideas. Let's just throw this against the wall and see what sticks. Or Wonder Woman. As soon as everybody starts wearing Lycra pantsuits and wearing crystals, we're out in the woods. I don't want to see that. Yeah. I need to see her shooting Nazis.
I really want to just step in real quick and explain to our listeners, because there might be some listeners out there who may have heard the expression jump the shark but don't realize where it came from. And Mark Finn is correct. An episode of Happy Days, one of the later episodes of Happy Days, had Arthur Fonzarelli, the Fonz, who was the cool motorcycle-driving, leather jacket-wearing young adult man in school. I don't know if he went to school. But in one episode, he enters like a skiing contest, and he literally jumps on a ramp on water skis, wearing a leather jacket, by the way.
Oh, no. That is later, but the first time he does it, it's on the motorcycle.
Yeah, it's on the motorcycle.
Wait, he jumps a shark on a motorcycle?
Yes, there's a tank with a shark on it, and he jumps.
See, are there lasers attached to it? Skiing episode.
No. It was the
it's on the motorcycle.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me! I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it's the they put a shark tank outside of Alfred's.
What?
I'm telling you. Once again, out of ideas completely. And what happened is you know. This is what happens. You know, there's always a point. I guess it was Frank Marshall. Hey, you know what the kids are into these days? That evil Knievel is going gangbusters.
And Jaws.
So I just saw this movie called Jaws. I got an idea. Fonz rides a motorcycle. Let's have him jump a shark. The kids go nuts.
Oh, my God.
That's good. That's one of the pastrami sandwich and talk about.
That's what it is. And so,
that's a good idea. I had no idea he had jumped two sharks.
Yeah, I remember the episode where he jumped the shark, and he was, in fact, on his motorcycle when he was jumping the shark.
Yeah, it was
weird. I remember it being on skis in the water.
I remember watching it as a kid going, well, that's a lame jump.
Yeah, I think the skis gets more airplay because it's even more ridiculous.
Yeah. That's the one I remember. Is him in his swimming trunks with his skis and his leather jacket, and he goes over the ramp, and there's a shark. Oh my gosh! Oh, Fonzie. Yeah.
Wow. I don't remember the one with the skis. Maybe I just blocked it.
He was crossing the bear with it. No.
We've all blocked it.
About Wonder Woman, though, real quick, Mark. I did see something online that gave a little teaser of the Wonder Woman movie, and guess what? She's fighting Nazis.
Yeah, I know. I'm so excited.
I know, me too.
I think they have her throughout history. They cover her, because she's 5,000 years old.
For Jesus Christ.
In Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
She is 5,000 years old.
Wait, that didn't work well for the beginning of the Wolverine movie. Actually, that was the only good part of the Wolverine movie.
They're gonna show her throughout history.
That's awesome. But they do show she does in fact fight Nazis.
Oh,
and the character the captain. Trevor. Yeah, he's in World War II.
Love the idea of Steve Trevor, this badass airplane pilot kind of guy who somehow captures her heart. This is an immortal. This is an Amazon, and yet this cocky son of a gun from Brooklyn or wherever he's from, she falls for him. I like that.
Well,
no, it's the bad boy.
Joseph,
it's the bad boy.
It's Chris Pine. I mean, come on.
Well, hell yes. I fall for Chris Pine.
Good Lord. Those baby blue eyes, you know?
You kidding?
Proto Captain Kirk, man. Sign me the hell up.
You're the bee's knees, Chris Pine.
Prince Charming.
I'm in.
Oh, Lord.
I love it. Going back to Kolchak, simply because I adore that show. He's my spirit animal, quite frankly.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that Chris Carter was so influenced by. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and a lot of Mulder's dialogue is obviously Kolchak without the hard-bitten reporter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice.
There was an episode of the TV show, one of my favorite episodes, probably the scariest episode of the TV show, in my opinion, was the zombie episode.
Second episode.
I remember it.
And Kolchak, there's a zombie that this voodoo.
Like a real zombie.
An actual zombie,
not what we think today of
as
a zombie.
That is correct. The zombie who cannot eat meat or salt, or he will return to his grave. That's the zombie we're talking about, not the ghoul that Romero created in 69.
Right.
That's a different type of zombie.
Yeah.
We're talking about a zombie who is just basically picking people up, breaking them over his knee, snapping people in half like twigs, physically imposing massive, gigantic, bald, Tor Johnson-looking thing.
Yeah.
So Kolchak does his research, figures out how to stop it, crawls into the back of this old abandoned car in this junkyard where they're storing the zombie, the ones who are controlling it, and in the dark, sweaty, terrifying enclosure of this small back, the back of this wagon, he's pouring salt into the zombie's mouth and sewing the lips of the zombie shut.
I remember that.
And it's terrifying.
Yeah, because his eyes pop
he
open.
Opens his eyes, yeah. And Kolchak screams like a girl, which I totally did, yeah, as well. And, you know, and hustles it out of there. It's a, it's nerve-wracking. He's sweating. He's fumbling with a thread and needle trying to sew the mouth.
I think
shut.
I may have found the ultimate fanfic for us. Kolchak teaming up with Phil Lovecraft, Private Eye.
Ooh,
nice.
There you go.
Nice. Well, and by the way, and so. Phil. I think mm-hmm. that's what I really liked about Kolchak is that they dealt with a lot of mythologies. Do you remember the Rakshasa?
Oh, yeah.
They dealt with these great monsters from mythology that were not European. You know, they were these Asian, Indian. Mm-hmm, yep. And I thought, wow, how cool. I immediately went and started reading as much as I could. Of course, I played D&D at the time, so I was like, oh, I know what a Rakshasa is.
Yeah, and if we have any Jim Butcher fans on listening to the podcast, this is a good series for you.
That's actually what I didn't mind Monster of the Week. I was young enough that for me, it was a monster. And so, you know, as far as I was concerned, you've done your job. Okay, here's a cool monster that I either know about or don't know about. My favorite episode was the werewolf episode, not because it's a good werewolf, but because of how it opens. He has this wonderful little factoid that he reads out as
it's
watching.
On the luxury liner,
it's
right?
A swingers cruise.
Yes, I remember that.
Swingers cruise.
I remember that's a great episode.
Well, and what's so cool about it is, you know, while the attack is happening, he's reading, you know, in the last 100 years of the United States, there has never been a case of someone being fatally attacked by a wolf, and then it freeze frames on the werewolf throwing the body over the edge of the ocean liner, the bridge there, and I just love the it's a great juxtaposition because, you know, at the time, you know, whenever there was a werewolf movie, you know, there would always be what looks like he's been clawed by a wolf. You know, always, you know.
Yeah.
And so I like the fact that he just sort of takes that off the table, you know, right there.
Yeah.
That was such a cool, I felt like a confident way of doing the storytelling. And it's this is a good case of giving me your premise up front in the case of the Night Stalker. Here's a guy who doesn't believe in monsters and is trying real hard to not believe in monsters because the alternative is madness and death.
right.
So I'm going to keep trying to find a good reason to not believe in monsters. Meanwhile, the vampire's killing people. So that's a case where you can show, you can have an interesting story, or it's okay sometimes if people know your premise, because I think there's an adage in creative writing, and a lot of creative writing professors will tell you, not just regarding the basics, but real creativity comes when you set up barriers, when you set up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have impositions that you have to work around or constraints that you have to work within. And so telling me the monsters are real, but I'm going to try real hard to deal with them because I'm just a guy and I'm not equipped for any of this.
Right.
You know, that's as good a premise as any to tell a compelling story.
He gets better in terms of preparing.
Yes.
I remember the after the first episode when, you know, the vampire and then the Ripper, he never had a retrospective moment where he said he's facing the headless motorcycle guy or whatever, and he says to himself, crap, why does this keep happening to me? He never says, you know, 2 weeks ago when I fought that zombie, he never says that. Each episode is like a brand new experience for
him.
Yeah.
And he never reflects on the fact that what the hell is going on except the vampire episode in the TV show.
Yes.
Because he immediately responds. He goes into action. He knows exactly what to do. He even knows exactly where this vampire came from Las Vegas. This was a victim of Janos Skorzeny, who is a female vampire. And he just, I mean, he goes to town on her. He knows exactly what to do. And the way he takes her out at the end is classic. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant way to finish his vampire off once and for all. He's on that one. He has that.
It's kind of a shame that they couldn't find a way to extend that idea out a little bit more. When it comes to television, I feel like sometimes I'm the only guy in the room that has this viewpoint. I'm okay with less is more. If I got if I got 12 great episodes, I don't need 4 seasons where the last 3 are mediocre. You know,
right.
I'll take what I can get if it's good. and yeah. and not feel like and not feel necessarily gypped. Because to me, if I only have to watch one season of a show, well, that frees me up to watch other things that I might have missed, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that was my lament always about, you know, True Detective, is we started watching the second season, and we got two episodes in, and we lost interest. You know, if there needs to be a show. And by the way, I'm working towards that end, but there needs to be a show. That's very Lovecraftian in feel, but it's not played like Buffy. It's not played like Angel. It's done like True Detective. It's done like True Detective, except the stuff out there, the horrors, it's real. It's not just metaphysical. It's not just in this guy's head because he was on drugs. It's real. And I think whoever comes up with the alchemy to create that show and give it to us on a regular basis, mm-hmm. where you have these serious, very flawed, I like to call it beautifully flawed mm-hmm. characters,
yeah.
Encountering this stuff over and over and over again, which is slowly opening up this very, very deep abyss, you know, the mm-hmm. whole thing about the things look back at you. And so they're struggling to maintain their sanity, they're struggling with whatever other problems they have, be it, you know, a drug addiction or whatever it is. That show, I think, will be a great success. It'll be dark. Fans will be hitting the internet and looking stuff up when you drop any reference about any kind of god or book or ancient mad sorcerer.
Yeah.
Fans love that kind of stuff.
And, you know, really, the first one out of the gate on this was probably Abraham Van Helsing, who walked into a room and said, "What's going on here, folks?" He said, "Well, we don't know what's going on with Lucy. She's losing her color, and she's very weak, and let me look at her." It's a vampire.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what? Yeah, it's a vampire. You're out of your mind. The strength of the vampire is that those people will not believe in him. You have to understand what you're dealing with here, folks. Come on.
Yeah.
Get on. You know, he was the guy. He walked into the room with no qualms, and he nailed it. So in the tradition of Van Helsing, Abraham, moving forward into Fox Mulder or Carl Kolchak or any of these characters who explore the unknown to come up with solutions, hopefully, to fix this this issue, I think we owe a lot to the idea of a hero. And our heroes over the years, we've talked about it, have become flawed. They have problems. They have issues. Marvel Comics, thank you very much. They all have problems. They got to pay the rent. They got girlfriends to break up with, and their friends are on drugs. They got problems. I really enjoy when a hero comes out on top, even if he comes out from, the problems that we discussed. Van Helsing, Abraham, I keep saying that because I'm not talking about Gabriel Van Helsing with his incredible hair. I'm talking about Abraham Van Helsing. he came in the authority. He knew exactly what to do.
Yes. And
I like that because you look up to that man. You're like, what do you want me to do? What, you tell me what to do, and I will do
it
because
right.
I believe that you know what you're talking about.
Right.
You know, but over the years, our heroes have become flawed and become real. And yes, we relate to them. I like that. But I would like to also have the flawed heroes, and there's somebody there who I know exactly. I'm strong in my faith. I'm strong in my belief. I'm strong as a person. I know exactly what to do. Trust me.
And we get those sometimes, and they die early on. So the fall.
Right, right. Why? Why do they have to die?
But you know what? When you think about it, if you're from the perspective of the monster,
right.
If you know that there's a group of ragtag heroes and one of them is the Van Helsing character, mm-hmm. that's the one you need to kill.
Yes.
and good luck with that, because that's exactly what Dracula did.
Yeah.
Dracula tried to. He cornered him in a room all by himself and said, "Okay, you know me. I know you. Here's your chance. Leave. Go back to where you came from. Just leave us alone." And Van Helsing's like, "No. I know exactly what you are. I know how to deal with you." And there's a beautiful confrontation between the two of them where Dracula says, "All right, fine. Come here." And Van Helsing resists. And then Dracula says, "Okay, I'm going to come to you now." And then there's that beautiful exchange between the two of them where he pulls out not garlic, not a crucifix. He pulls out the host, the actual transubstantiated body of Christ, holds it up in front of Dracula, who screams like a scalded dog and runs out the window.
Yeah.
He had a dispensation from the cardinal. He could do that because you can't take it out of the church, folks.
Yeah.
But he did. That's how prepared he was. I love that. Van Helsing knew exactly what to do.
Which, by the way, of the versions of that confrontation, the one I love, it's not the best version of Dracula, or at least the most true, but it's the one with
Langella.
Lawrence Olivier. The power of those two actors when they're doing that scene.
Yeah. Sacrilege!
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. It's great. That whole, and you know, Langella has that condition where his eyes twitch back and forth. Yeah. And I never knew what it was that I found deeply just disturbing about his portrayal of Dracula. But he does that. It's a close-up on him. He goes, "Come here!" And his eyes are twitching back and forth, and they're so dark. And you're like, what is he doing? I don't know what he's doing. And then Lawrence Olivier, of course, you know, stops and just stares at him. And he goes, "Your will is strong. Then I will come to you." Right. And it pulls out that host, and it's just like, and yeah, the fact that Dracula, that this prince of darkness, this demon, screams sacrilege and then jumps out the window. It's just beautiful. There's so much wonderful subtext going on there about who is Van Helsing, who is Dracula, who is Vlad in that scene.
To me, the sacrilege line, it's a hollow thing, you know, because Dracula knows you can't take it out of the church. And so that's, you know.
So he's going, "Oh, that's so gauche."
Yeah, he's
right. How dare you?
Basically, yeah. How dare you
get out of the church?
You're not playing fair.
Yeah.
You're not playing fair. You're not allowed to do that.
He's telling Van Helsing, who's supposedly the angel of the good side, he's telling him, "You're committing sacrilege."
And I want to make this very clear. That scene, in fact, even the 1931 Lugosi and Edward Van Sloan scene, which is a great one too, those scenes were based on the original Hamilton Dean and John L. Balderston play.
Nice.
Of Dracula, where he does that. He pulls the host out, and then in the play, he didn't do it in the movie, unfortunately, but in the play, when Harker and Seward come in, he says, "What is that?" "It's the host. It's the transubstantiated body of Christ." And he says, "Well, how could you get that?" And he goes, "That's okay. No sacrilege was committed. I had a dispensation from the cardinal to do it." He explains
that's
it
nice
in the play. Very important, because you know it wouldn't work otherwise.
Meanwhile, Dracula
had,
just yells,
"I
can't even," and
runs
off.
Everybody would know. back when they were doing that play originally, that would have been a big deal. Now
it
I don't
really
think anybody.
Would.
Unless you're a practicing Catholic, I don't think you would get it. But you know,
well, you know, and because you've opened up this door, one of my favorite stories of the original run in 1927 of Lugosi's on Broadway doing Dracula in that production with Edward Van Sloan as Van Helsing on Broadway as well. Clara Bow, America's It Girl, was in California, and they were touring the show, and you couldn't get tickets to that show for blood or money. You just couldn't. They were constantly sold out. So Clara Bow's at a pool party at her house, as she does, and she's told by her assistant, "Hey, Clara, got tickets, front row Dracula." She leaps out of the pool in her wet swimsuit, throws a mink coat on, because that's what she did back then, and rushes to the theater. She sits in the front row, watching Bela Lugosi chew scenes and chew necks on that, squirming in her wet swimsuit underneath her mink coat. After the play, she insists on meeting him. "I must meet this actor. I must meet Bela Lugosi." So they bring her backstage, America's It Girl, and Bela Lugosi, in his very broken English, because as we all know, he learned his lines phonetically in the beginning. He didn't speak any English. He had to learn his lines phonetically. He somehow managed to express to her enough in English where they started this amazingly toured love affair. Dracula and Clara Bow. Bela Lugosi and Clara Bow had this amazingly toured love affair that lasted, oh, I don't know, maybe a few months. But in that few months, Lugosi, this is the final bit of this, Lugosi commissioned a nude painting to be done of Clara Bow. And had it done, she posed for it, had it painted, and that nude painting of Clara Bow hung in his house through all his wives, through all his life. There was this gigantic nude painting of Clara Bow in his house.
Nice.
And he was like, "Yes, I topped that."
Oh my God, that is brilliant!
I knew about the love affair. I didn't know about the painting. That's wow. That's
because
awesome.
There was no internet yet, so it wasn't posted.
Yeah, and by the way, the same things that audiences and especially women were saying about Lugosi on the run on Broadway was the same thing they were saying about Frank Langella when he was performing it as a stage play as well. That he would come in onto the stage. And you could hear the sighs of the women and probably a few men in the audience. He had that much power when he was doing those performances. And so when it came time, we have to do a movie version of this. There was no question that it was going to be Frank Langella in the role of Dracula. But jumping back to X-Files, so...
Oh, I'm going to go even a further tangent for a split second.
Okay.
Yeah. If you want to see another fun version of Frank Langella, there was a short-lived, I think they only aired 3 episodes, but you can get the DVD, Bradley Cooper sitcom from the guy who did Sex and the City called Kitchen Confidential.
Okay.
Wow.
Where Frank Langella is the owner of the restaurant. It's Bradley Cooper being a chef.
Wow.
And he's the owner of the restaurant, and you never quite know if he's mob or not, but he plays it kind of as a quiet, understated godfather vampire.
Oh, wow. And the award for most obscure reference of the night goes to Mickey Finn.
Well played, sir.
So
wow.
Back to the X-Files.
Wow.
Wow. Nice.
We touched on that Vampire in the Woods episode with the two different viewpoints. That being one of my favorite ones for a number of reasons. Chief of them, I like, first of all, great storytelling idea. Because these two guys, you know, what's fun about it is, of course, the conceit from the show was that they're never going to agree. So why not have those reports be two very different things? So it was just a nice extension of that after, you know, 6 seasons. Yeah. But I loved the, if you'll forgive the Vonnegut-ism of art disappearing up its own asshole, this idea of the role-playing guys, you know, in the woods running around, and the line from that show that just kills me is when Mulder and Scully are questioning one of the guys about, you know, what it is he saw or, you know, why didn't you run? He says, I'd like to think that 10 years of playing Dungeons and Dragons taught me a little something about courage.
I forget
what the exact quote is, but that's
that's pretty much it.
I think that is it.
And I just love that. You know, of course.
And just the attitude of, like, remember he throws the seeds on the floor.
That's right.
And the chubby vampire's like, oh, why did you do that?
Yeah,
then he bends down and starts pit 1, 2.
Yes.
And that's really obscure. And again, like we talked about the host, who would know that?
Yeah.
I mean, Americanized mythologies of vampires, I think that's what Chris Carter did really well in the X-Files, is dive deep and pull things out like the seeds.
Yeah.
You know, where people went, why is that vampire counting seeds?
That's what you did in Eastern Europe.
Toss those on the ground, you know? Absolutely.
Gotta be corn.
And we got so many things out of the X-Files. There was a band called Shriekback, a great band that on their Greatest Hits album, they had this chart showing how their band members went on to do so many other things in so many other groups. And you could do that with the X-Files, with both cultural significance and the actual talent. Not only do we have a lot of actors that these days, you know, they might be like your cult actor that you like, that you go back and watch an X-Files episode and you're like, he was in that. You know,
I'll tell you the best thing that X-Files did. It moved the acceptance bar forward. You know, up until X-Files, the big geek show that everybody kind of rallied around was Star Trek: The Next Generation, and it was syndicated. Why that's a deal is, you know, it wasn't always on the same channel at the same time at the same place from city to city. For the X-Files to come out on Fox and have a regular time in their prime time lineup was a big deal. And, you know, despite its flaws, I give it full marks for essentially building an audience for things like Lost, things like True Detective, things like True Blood. You know,
you're right. That's one of the first times I remember people remarking out loud, I got to get home, X-Files on.
That's right. That was X-Files was can't miss TV because everybody was going to talk about it the next day.
I don't remember a show before that where people were specifically saying that.
And the talent went off to do other things. Breaking Bad was a show that came later where everybody's like, oh, Breaking Bad's on, I got to go watch it.
That's right.
And Vince Gilligan, who was a producer on the X-Files.
So I think that's, you know, we definitely, you know, whether or not I like it is immaterial.
But you do like it. You do like several aspects.
Yeah, I do. I like certain things about it. And I'm really
looking
forward.
You want a good parts version.
I do. I want to literally take out. I want to not watch every episode having to do with the aliens and the abductions, because all of a sudden that becomes a tight little show with some really cool nasty stuff and an interesting through line. Because the tangential part of that did work for me was the cigarette smoking man and the lone gunman.
The
conspiracy parts of that really worked, and if you put the aliens in that larger conspiracy, I'm down. It's when we start going to Area 51 and dealing with autopsies and again, it all goes back to Mulder's sister, and all that was just hooey. It's like the piping on the Next Generation Enterprise. You know, it's GNDN goes nowhere, does nothing. You know. none of that ever really.
Episode that actually deals with that is the pilot episode, is actually good enough that I remember when the previews for this came out, there was some confusion. They kind of promoted it as if it was dramatizations of real life stories of abductions.
Pilot is quite good.
I didn't want to watch it. I was watching VR5. Oh, did that show go nowhere real quick? I was watching VR5 on the couch, too sick to get up and change the channel and watch the beginning of the X-Files by accident because I was going to avoid it.
Right. Well, that's the other thing that the X-Files is known for. Is that unlike so many other shows, the pilot's actually good.
Yes.
The pilot is quite good.
You know, I'll have to rewatch it. I don't think I did.
You should watch it.
I don't remember it.
I remember that. You know, by the way, we didn't see them when they were first coming out. I knew of the show. My friends would talk about it all the time. We never watched it. We started watching it, Blythe and I, when they started releasing them on Netflix. And you would mail the get the DVDs mailed to you and you'd play them. And so that is what our introduction.
Lord knows you couldn't start watching them on DVD by buying the sets. They were $120 for a season.
No. We didn't do that. We actually waited until they hit Netflix. So, you know, we're talking, this is already 2003 or so, 2000, around there. So we sat down and we watched the pilot, and both Bob and I were like, wow, that was surprisingly good. That was really good. And then, of course, started watching all the episodes, and, you know, the first, so many of the classic episodes are from the first two seasons.
Yeah.
And so, we were hooked. We were hooked. But we were so impressed with the pilot that we knew we were going to, even if nobody had told us anything else about the show, we were going to watch the show.
And Mark, if you've got access to the DVDs, it's fun to watch the bloopers from first season.
Oh, I bet.
I think Kathy's actually got some of the early episodes, seasons on DVD.
As great as Gillian Anderson is now, she was fresh off the boat in there and flubbed her lines consistently, and it frustrated the crap out of her. There are some great bloopers of her just going.
I love Gillian Anderson. I'm just such a fan of hers. And
yes.
One of the reasons I was watching Hannibal, not only is it a fantastic show, canceled now, but Gillian Anderson was on that show, and I'm compelled to watch her when she's on screen.
I'm very confused that she agreed to come back at half the pay that...
She fixed that. Yeah,
oh, she fixed
I think
that.
She
okay.
discovered yes. that they offered her half the pay.
Oh, okay.
And I think people became involved, and it was like, oh, hell no.
Because I'm like, people shouldn't...
No.
Well, you know what? Unlike the piping on the Enterprise, which goes nowhere and does nothing, the Gentlemen Nerds do go places and they do things. fact, you might want to take note of that clever segue, folks. In February, Valentine's weekend, the Gentlemen Nerds will be appearing
in two different places.
In two different places. And Mickey Finn, what's going on with the Gentlemen Nerds in Dallas?
There's a con in Dallas called ConDFW. That is going to have Mark, Aaron, and I invading several panels and even in front of a live studio audience recording episode 9 of The Gentleman Nerds. And a couple hours before that, we will be trying to outwit dastardly aliens and asteroids and black holes in Artemis, guys versus gals.
Ooh.
Yes.
That should be fun. That should be fun.
And so, and what, and it's the entire weekend? Is it Friday, Saturday,
and Sunday? It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
It builds itself as a literary science fiction and fantasy convention with an emphasis on the written word. So, okay. So what's nice about that
we've got John Scalzi and, you know.
While there is some media stuff, it's mostly an emphasis on books and book writers and storytelling and things like that. And you can find out more about it by going to condfw.org. condfw.org.
Yep. And that is the weekend, the February 12th, 13th, and 14th in Dallas.
Yes. And so it is the 13th that we're having the Gentleman Nerds events, so you don't have to skip out on your sweetie.
And you also don't have to miss your gig, Joseph. What do you got going?
Yes,
I unfortunately will not be with you. And it breaks my heart because it's that opportunity to actually put a living human being to the mysterious voices I've been hearing over the over my headsets these past few wonderful weeks. So I'm looking forward to actually meeting you in person, Mark Finn and Mickey Finn. Yes, audience, I've never actually met them. But I am not going with the Gentleman Nerds, unfortunately, because I will be doing another event here in Austin, Texas at Svanthor. It's a wax museum honoring the history of horror films in wax. And I will be doing an event with Victoria Price, the daughter of Vincent Price.
Nice.
We will be hosting a tribute to her father. As my horror host character from Fangoria TV, Professor Griffin, will be doing private wax museum tours. And doing a Q&A with Victoria and, of course, emceeing the event, et cetera, et cetera. So that'll be on Valentine's Day at Svanthor Horror Museum in Austin, Texas, 1 o'clock, February 14th.
Will that be recorded and aired anywhere?
You know what? I don't know. I'm considering trying to dredge something up to do that. We'll see.
That'd be great. Yeah. That'd be great. Which, by the way, I would be at that event.
Oh yeah, me too.
Yes, at CONDFW. That sounds fantastic. I have said several times on the show, I am a huge fan of the character of Professor Griffin.
Yes.
I think he is an amazing creation. I wish he was still on the air. And hopefully maybe that will happen in the near future.
I'll see what I can do. I'll talk to him.
Yeah. Four seasons of the movie.
It's nice that that he does make the occasional appearance as well, because I got nothing but love for the prof. He's good people in my book.
Yes, he is.
He'll be pleased to hear this. Well, gentlemen, they're dimming the lights here in the Lobot Lounge. Let's finish our drinks. Unfortunately, it's once again that time. In parting words, I think we should impart to our listeners how important it is to have an open mind. I want to tell a very, very quick apocryphal story about the man at the bus stop. You see, there's a man. He gets up every morning and he goes to the bus stop. He leans up against a brick wall and he waits for his bus to arrive. Every morning he does this. He gets up in the morning, he goes to the bus stop, catches his bus while leaning up against a brick wall, goes to work every single morning. One day he gets up, goes to the bus stop, leans up against the wall, falls through the wall, and has a heart attack before he actually reaches the bottom, because his reality was shattered. The thing that he counted on every single day was gone. Somehow he just fell right through it, and his mind couldn't conceive it. He could not accept it, so he died. Ladies and gentlemen, open your minds. The truth is out there. There's a possibility. It's a possibility that what you think is true is not. Mark Finn, final words?
I am hoping to see some of you guys at CONDFW, and thanks to all of you who have been listening so far. We're really glad that you're coming along with us.
Indeed. Mickey Finn?
Do not be like Mulder. Actually say goodbye when you hang up the phone.
That's right. You never did. Mr. Derive.
Likewise, thank you so much to all the listeners out there. We do this for the love of it, but we also do it to entertain the listeners, and comments are always welcome. Go to the website, thegentlemannerds.com, and let us know what you think. Let us know, give us ideas for future episodes, shows you'd like us to cover, books, magazines, comics, whatever you would like us to cover. Give us some ideas on Gentleman Nerds. And we will
consider
pick from those topics.
And there's a Facebook group as well if you'd like to join the community.
Yes, please. Gentleman Nerds on Facebook.
Where we just post random cool stuff.
which is great. That's what Facebook is all about. Posting random stuff. So All right, folks, thank
well,
you.
Well, here we are again saying goodnight. Remember, whatever odd things you hear, whatever strange, unusual, terrifying things you hear, just relax and keep telling yourself, it can't happen here. Good night.
The Gentleman Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design at thegentlemannerds.com by Rustix Interactive. Promotional consideration by Morley Cigarettes, produced in Groom Lake, Nevada.